Welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. I'm Colleen Johnson. My co-host today is Andy Cleff.
Hey, Col.
Hello. And today we're joined by Rahul Bhattacharya of the Agile Atelier podcast. Welcome, Rahul.
Thanks, Colleen. Thanks, Andy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Did Colleen get your last name pronunciation close to right?
She did. That was very impressive.
She nailed it then, because we have a tradition here on the Agile Uprising podcast. I think, was it started by Gifford? I forget who, but we usually butcher people's names, even though we practice them up front. Well done, Colleen.
Thanks. I wasn't quite sure if I got that right either, but some practice makes perfect, hopefully. Well, we're happy to have you here, Rahul. I had the pleasure of being on your podcast a couple months ago and have watched you continue to book some pretty incredible guests since then. You've had just a great stream of content and really strong Agile, you know, voices in the Agile community. What brought you to start a new Agile podcast?
Yeah, firstly, thanks, Colleen. The reason I started this podcast is to have the space for discussions around best practices in the lean and agile space. In the podcast, I take vague and seemingly esoteric topics and buzzwords that people often hear about in the industry. And I try to break it down into something that everyday listeners can use regardless of the industry they're working in or the role that they've found themselves in. As you mentioned, I've had the pleasure of hosting guests in the past, such as Marty Kagan, Jeff Gothelf, Alan Clement, Jeff Haddon, and of course, Agile Uprising's very own Colleen Johnson herself.
the well-known, infamous Colleen Johnson.
And on your podcast, what are some of the, do you have any highlights or any very memorable episodes or surprising episodes that you've hosted?
A memorable one that I recently released is called Empowered Engineers with Marty Kagan. And so we talk about, you know, what that looks like in product teams. And we sort of talk about the different types of teams found in organizations and what it means to be empowered for engineers and what are some practices that they can implement to get to that point.
Great. Thinking about the people doing the work instead of just the process.
Yeah. And rather than sort of getting a list of features fed down their throats, you know, they're actually empowered to solve problems and think more holistically about the product itself.
Well, that's a great segue into thinking a little bit more about product and problems, which is your sweet spot, right? This is the domain that you like to play in.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, for our listeners who might not be super familiar with the terminology, how would you describe product discovery or that understanding what problem to solve?
Yeah, the short answer would be trying to learn as quickly as possible. The longer definition that I tend to use is that it's basically a group of activities or practices that individuals and teams can use when they're working in complex environments where they need to learn quickly about the problem, which is often changing, right, from time to time. And it should be done as often as possible so that they can then iterate on the different solutions and the different tactical parts of the product that they're using for delivery.
So you talk a little bit about when and where frequently. Who is involved in this? And I'm curious, can we tie it back into the empowered dev team, the engineers? Who's part of the discovery process?
Yeah, that's a good question. Ideally, everyone. So in a team or an organization that's taking the most advantage out of something like product discovery, it's a team sport. So it should not just be the product owner, or the product manager, and maybe the design or the UX team, right? It should be including the engineers and other members of the team. So ideally, everyone on the team. But having said that, different members will play different parts, different roles in product discovery. So for example, engineers may not always be involved at every single step or every single phase of discovery. But I think it's important to have their input through the various stages.
How does this play out with a methodology like Scrum? Where does it happen? Who are there backlog stories or tickets? Because you're not really getting a potentially shippable product increment up front when you're doing the discovery work, are you?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. Ideally, discovery always leads to some sort of delivery. When you're looking at a framework like Scrum, it really depends on the context that the team is using something like Scrum in. So for example, if you have feature teams that have a backlog that are pre-decided with certain features, there really isn't much scope for discovery to be done, right? On the other hand, if you are working with a product team that is maybe empowered to solve problems, and you know, they have maybe a little bit of scope and room to think more about the problem that they're solving, then you can think about applying certain product discovery practices in that case.
And you talked a little bit about roles briefly, but I'm also curious, do you find that where there's structure, where we have roles like a product owner, that this becomes a little bit of somebody else's job or somebody else's problem to solve when we have more discrete, you know, definition of roles and responsibilities on a Scrum team?
Yeah, I think it could be. And what I was trying to hint at with the earlier answer was beyond the roles, it really falls back on the culture, right? And this having this culture of doing certain practices rather than just, you know, one role being responsible for something like the product tickets, right? Coming up with product features. And the best sort of agile teams, whether it's Scrum or other frameworks, the roles are very fluid and they're interchangeable. And people often help each other out, right? And work collaboratively to solve customer problems.
It just bubbled up in my mind, the Google Ventures approach, which they tagged the name Design Sprints years ago. Is there a similarity to this approach? Is this an evolution of that way of time boxing with a cross-functional team, discovery, solutioning, testing, and feedback?
Yeah, I think when you think about the classical sort of the sprint, right, the five-day sprint of discovery, in my opinion, that focuses a lot in the solution space, as you were hinting at, Andy. Because it's very heavy on prototyping, validating, coming up with an MVP. And, you know, and I'm sort of speculating here, but when Google Ventures sort of created this and ran this, they were maybe working in an environment where they wanted to loop certain product discovery practices into an existing framework like Scrum, right? But I think one thing that it misses is what Design Sprint typically misses is focus on the problem space, right? Where you're maybe figuring out what the right question is and coming to an alignment about what you're trying to solve rather than going through the prototyping, the testing, the validating, et cetera.
I think what's interesting about that, and I would totally agree with you. I think some of the flaws we see in some of these practices are trying to jam them together, right? But I think the reality is where there is a lot of structure in place, and maybe it's safe or it's Scrum, we have to figure out where do we make space for these activities, like that, you know, backing up from the solution and understanding the problem. So where do you see that intersection of some of these product discovery patterns with more structured agile practices?
Yeah, I think more than the structure of the framework such as Scrum, to me it sort of comes back to the context of the team or the organization and sort of tying it to culture, right? So are the teams that are trying to use something like product discovery practices in a place to do that, right? Do they have the freedom from hierarchy to question the problem that they're trying to solve? Or are they expected to get a list of features that they need to develop every sprint, right? So it really comes down to that. But in my opinion, the best sort of product discovery teams that I've seen use it in a continuous fashion in some sense. And they use it iteratively to build on the results of previous approaches and previous tests and previous experiments that they've done. And traditionally, they also don't do it non-linearly. So, you know, they don't go step by step and talk first about the ideation, then maybe the prototyping, but sort of pick and choose based on the questions that they're trying to answer for the customers.
You mentioned culture, the culture shift required a couple times. Where do you start to introduce the change? If it's, you know, culture is often the hardest part to change, right? In what yeah. we, where do you start to introduce this to see that shift in thinking?
Yeah, to me, it comes down to learning about the different practices or the components that makes up something like product discovery, something like agile, right? So rather loosely termed umbrellas for different frameworks and practices. And once you do understand where and when you can use certain practices, what the purpose is, what are some variations, maybe look at some case studies, then you can maybe try and apply one or two of them in your context. And then you might end up learning a lot more, not just about the practice itself, but also about your context and the team in which you operate.
I want to roll back a little bit to the concept of problem space and solution space and ask you to unpack those a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. So typically in the problem space, you are defining the problem, right? What is the customer problem? And this is sometimes tricky because when you work with organizations, a lot of times the answers that you'll get is, you know, a problem that the customer is facing is that they don't have feature X or feature Y. And for me, that is not really a problem, right? A lack of features in a product is not really the customer's problem. Their problem is the fact that they can't carry out a certain functionality or use a product to get a job done in the jobs to be done theory language. So in the problem space, you're really trying to understand what are the customer's pain points and why do they need to use your product in the first place? You know, so there are different ways to define that. You can do things like user interviews. You can do some brainstorming. You can look at something like diary work to understand really the behavioral aspect of how customers are trying to use your product, but also what they're trying to accomplish with that. And then in the solution space, this is where something like a design sprint approach is very heavy on. So you have different practices for prototyping, for validating, for checking, for product market fit, and so on. So that's how they, at a high level, sort of differ.
Yeah. So back to the problem space, I'm curious the techniques you use to challenge not only your own assumptions, but to conduct user research in a open way that avoids the classic Henry Ford problem, right? If Henry Ford had talked to his customers and asked them what they needed, his famous quote is, faster horses, not automobiles. So how do you challenge not only your own assumptions, but then do empirical research in such a way that the problem space is broadened before you bring it back to we need faster horses?
You know, hearing you sort of say that quote reminds me of the jobs to be done theory, sort of classic example of the milkshake. Right. So there's this experiment that was done where researchers went into a McDonald's and they're trying to find out what makes the milkshake such a good drink to buy prior to driving into work. Why were all these commuters buying this chocolate milkshake? So they did lots of different interviews and they, you know, asked them about the smoothness of the milkshake, the makeup, you know, what sort of flavors were people using. You know, because that was a high quality, highly sort of selling product for McDonald's. And what they found out later was that all the milkshakes were sold before 8 a.m., right? So the people buying those milkshakes needed it for their commute into work. When they were driving to work, they had one hand on the steering wheel, another hand free, and they wanted to do something with it. The second problem that it solved was they needed something to sort of take up space in their stomachs, right? So they want to maybe have something to chew on or to suck on that would maybe not make them hungry, but also when they got to work maybe 30 minutes later, they would not be too stuffed either. So they tried something like a banana, right? And that didn't really cut it because it was gone in a matter of minutes. Something like a Snickers bar, gone in a matter of seconds, right? Something like a milkshake served the job perfectly because they could suck on that straw for 20, 30 minutes while they drove to work. It would keep them occupied. There was a cup holder in their car, so it didn't cause a mess. So it really sort of served that purpose, right? It did that job for the customers. So when you look at products from this perspective of what job does it do for your customers, it helps you think a little bit more about the problem that it's solving for them. And, you know, to give you a more detailed answer about this problem space question, something that I recently came across was Spotify's simultaneous triangulation approach. Ladies by the name of Colette Kalenda and Chrissy Savage, I believe, came up with this model at Spotify. They're in the user research team, and it basically consists of three steps. Firstly, you want to define the research objectives, right? What is the problem that you're trying to solve, and how is the research methods, how are these methods that you're using going to verify that? Secondly, you use something like a what-why framework to use different methods, right? So you can use the first method to look at the what, like the statistical modeling for quantitative data. And then you also need to address the why, right? So something like diary studies or user interviews will address why customers are making certain decisions to use your product or to not use your product or features within your product. So I really like this model because it combines a bunch of different techniques and different practices. And the bottom line that they say with this simultaneous triangulation model is to combine different methods rather than just using a preferred method for looking at the problem space. You apply a couple different methods from the what and from the why parts, and you use them simultaneously on the same user group so that you address certain blind spots that you may have if you use only one practice or one method. So those are some benefits and ways of maybe addressing and looking at the problem space.
You've had a lot of experience in this space. You've coached at some large organizations like Trivago, Blue Cross Blue Shield, Tyson Krupp. What's something that you see as kind of a common struggle with all of these large organizations in picking which of those practices, like you said, or maybe picking and choosing some of these different approaches and moving their product discovery practices forward?
Yeah, I think with these larger organizations, the common theme is the need for something like product discovery comes out of top-down management, right? So they say, why aren't we doing something like this, right? It sounds cool. It's something that we could potentially use to become better, whatever that means. And so what I've seen is that people often don't have a background about what they're trying to use it for. And they try to use it as a silver bullet to address problems that may or may not be aware of, right? So it's a bit dangerous when you're trying to use a tool without understanding what purpose that tool can help you serve, right? So often in larger organizations, what I've seen is when they do also refer to something like product discovery, they're speaking about the design sprint, the classical 5-day design sprint, which we just spoke about, right? And there's nothing wrong with that, but sometimes they're not in a space to be able to take advantage of something like a design sprint, right? Or it may not be the appropriate method or tool that they can use. So to get more specific, a lot of larger organizations tend to be top down, where, you know, the teams at the operational level or the departments don't really have that much say in the solutions that they're building. And when you're operating in such a way, you know, it doesn't matter if you use design sprint, it doesn't matter if you use something like simultaneous triangulation that I just spoke to. If you're not sort of allowing people to have these practices in the way it's meant to be, you're not going to be able to take advantage of them. So oftentimes, you know, when I've seen teams carry out product discovery, that refers to maybe prototyping, or that refers to maybe doing coming up with an MVP that's often over-engineered and then using their preferred way of testing it, which is often an A-B test or split test, right? And that could be a right approach, but, you know, you need to understand why you're using these methods and why you're taking these steps. So something like A-B testing is very good for looking at quantitative data, right, around the numbers of which parts of or which features of your product or service are being used more. But in the what and why framework that I just touched on earlier, you need to maybe include something from the why part, right? So something like a user interview to understand more about people's reactions and what causes them to use those certain features, and then iterate on that and develop solutions based on that. So, you know, long answer short, you need to be able to, as a team or as a department or as an organization, allow the teams working with product discovery to iterate on that and change the product that they're building, rather than being handed down from top down a list of features to build.
I did study abroad when I was in college in Chile, and when there's a massive traffic jam on the streets there, they call it a taco. I've often referred to what you just described as the feature taco, because there's no space anywhere to fit this in, right? We just jam one feature in the backlog after another, and we never give ourselves that breathing room.
Yeah, absolutely. And we can talk a little bit more about, you know, what some problems are in working in that way, but I don't want to sort of go off on a tangent here.
Let's go to the other side of the coin, the problems, but the solutions that they'll see. So when they're doing some of these, maybe they're incremental, maybe they're big changes from the what and why approach in the A-B. What are indicators that they're moving, they're changing in the right direction? What are indicators of success and contrary, you know, how do they know that things are getting worse? And is it a dip before they get better? What are some of the telltales?
Yeah, so that's a really interesting question. When I think about being in this solution space, it's not about sort of improving or not improving. I think a better way to think about it for me, an easier way, is whether it's validating your hypothesis or not. So are you proving or disproving your hypothesis with the experiments that you're running? So Teresa Torres actually has a really cool mental model for this that she calls the opportunity solution tree. You know, where you look at this desired outcome, which can be something like improving retention, right? Which you define in this problem space. And then in this opportunity space, you look at, you know, a little more about the tactics, right? What are some opportunities for us to improve on that? How do we measure it? And these are often defined by experiments and the hypotheses within those experiments. So when you either prove or disprove a hypothesis, you learn so much during that experiment, hopefully, one way or another, about whether this is the right approach based on your product strategy, whether, you know, you want to take step A as the next step or step B as the next step. And for me, you know, in the opportunity space, this is often where product strategy comes to life, right? So two companies in the same industry will often pick different opportunities, right? Depending on their product strategy of, it could be the same product. And at the end of the day, this ends up being their unique selling point. So based on the experiments they run, they can then decide whether we want to take this learning from experiment one or the other learning from experiment number five and then iterate on that. And this is why I think the problem space is even more important, because they want to understand the pain points that will help them, that will help sort of act as the guiding lights toward using certain opportunities to solve the customer needs that they want to solve.
I think the other thing that's interesting about what you were just touching on too, is I feel like we see a lot where we come up with those solutions first and then we try to understand what outcomes we're driving towards, and those outcomes mm-hmm. become very output focused, right? Or very focused on something that's tied to the solution rather than what was the original problem we were trying to solve or outcome we were driving towards. When you think about everything you're describing, I don't feel like you're going to get a lot of pushback from any of our listeners or any of this audience, right? I think everybody understands that there's a huge need for this, but organizationally, this is expensive and often requires additional headcount or more space between features or just more time to make this happen. So what are the really practical things you try to do with an organization that you're coaching to help them see the value in what you're describing?
Yeah, I think it's really interesting, Colleen, that you said, you know, it is something that is expensive, because, you know, at first glance, it does look like you're spending so much time defining the problem, whereas you could have just jumped to maybe coming up with a solution, for the customer. But I would really argue that it's more expensive to build something that is not serving the customer problems or customer needs, right? And yes, at the end of the day, it has to meet the business outcomes and it has to be profitable. But, you know, I honestly think it's more expensive when you don't know what you're trying to solve and, you know, sort of carry on in this output-minded fashion where you're too busy to think about the problem and you just develop certain features or certain tasks or, you know, different parts of the product, but you don't know what you're using that combination of features and tasks to solve, right? So to me, you know, it's not only sort of the right way of building a product, but also it helps save a lot of time, money, energy. So, you know, one of the things that I often do is a split test. So when I go into an organization and I start working with them, I ask the leadership, whoever's brought me in, how do we know, you know, we're going to be successful, right? What is that measure of success for not myself, but for something like product discovery, right? How can we see whether something like this can be applicable within your organization? So what I've done once in the past is take two teams in the same department working in a very similar way, very similar skill sets. And one of them, you know, I've tried to sort of incorporate some of these practices for product discovery, given that they're in a space to be able to think more about the problems and to be able to iterate on that, right? What we've seen in that case, in that example that I'm giving, is the team that is often empowered to solve these problems and maybe pick and choose their different discovery approaches often gets to the customer need much quicker, right? Because that is their starting point rather than a list of features that may come from stakeholders or management or whoever else. And, you know, talking to Marty Kagan last week as well, you know, he also mentioned that the best teams are not the ones that maybe are the most efficient at what they do. It's the ones that maybe are more effective at solving these problems and thinking more holistically in that sense.
You won't get any arguments from me on this one. How do these teams get access to the end user? Because obviously they need a lot of empathy with the customer to do both the problem exploration and the solutioning, and then finally delivery and the testing. What are some techniques that you found really useful to close the gap between the user and the maker?
Yeah, that's a good question. Depending on the product or service that the team or department or organization is working on, if it's a B2C product, they may have more access to the end users and to the end customers. Also, depending on the way the organization is set up, maybe they have a user research department, right? That's maybe responsible for having this touch point with users, bringing them in, doing things like interviews, diary studies. You know, if that is the case, you can then, as a team or department working on the product, leverage that, leverage the UX department of your team, the user research department, and collaborate with them, right? So if you're in a setup where it's not truly cross-functional, where the user research is spread out in the different teams and departments, you could find ways of working with that specific department and using their expertise to maybe help you create tests, talk about something like user journey mapping, what would that look like, and then ask behavioral questions to the users to solve, but to get to the bottom of the thing you're trying to test, right? Whether it's the click-through rate or whether it's converting from page A to page B, things of that nature. So, you know, I would suggest, depending on the way you're set up, that could be one way. If you are working in a B2B2C or B2B environment, that becomes much harder, right? Because you don't have, as a team that's building the product, you may not have access to the end users, right? Because they may be in another country, and maybe another part of the business may be taking care of that. But what you can do to get a little bit closer and to bridge that divide a little bit is work with that other part of the business, right? Work with that other department to talk about how is impact measured for these things that we're building for you. How are you guys knowing whether it's effective for the customers? Does it solve the customer problems? How are you measuring that? And if it's not happening, you can maybe start working with them in trying to come up with different ways and using these different practices from product discovery to do that, to look at the problems that you're solving, to measure the impact that your features, that your output is having in the change in customer behavior, which is the outcome.
You talked about at the end there, the change in customer behavior. And we could probably do a whole nother episode on how do you measure that, right? How do you fold that learning back into the process? But there's an element of that that's important here too, right? So you have one end of this funnel where you're understanding what problem to solve and iterating on solutions, but then what do you do with those? How do you fold that learning and that feedback loop back into this process as well?
Yeah. I think oftentimes when teams that are new to being in this problem space get carried away, right? So they define maybe a bunch of different problems that they could solve with the customer, or even at the opportunity space, right? When you have all these different potential ways of solving the problem and different experiments that you can run to touch on the different parts that all in one way or another would then change the customer behavior. How do you know what is sort of the right approach for that, right? So the answer for my side is using a combination of something like the product strategy, right? So what is your end goal with this product? What specific part of the needs are you trying to address? And also just prioritizing it. So it may not be that you can solve all 20 problems right away, but prioritize, come up with ways to identify what is the most important pain point with the users right now, whether it's through different behavioral questions in the user interviews, or something like affinity mapping, you know, prioritize those issues that the customer is having, and then start working on that. So that would be my short answer.
Well, when you talk about product strategy, do you see that as one overarching product strategy, this kind of one thing that should guide all of the things we touch? Or, and I'm asking that for selfish reasons, because I feel like what I see a lot with clients is that they want to be number one in five different categories, right? So it's like, how do you help them get that focus? So what is the, you know, what is our backlog for product strategy, or what is the number one priority from a product strategy perspective?
Yeah. And when we talk about product strategy, it depends a little bit on the stage that you find yourself in as a product, right? So, you know, if you're a startup or early stage product, then there may be a greater need to run more experiments to find out what exactly you want your product strategy to be, as you were saying, Colleen, right? So, you know, at the early stage, there may be an opportunity and a scope and a need to identify that strategy a little bit more and to come up with a better version of that. At a later stage, I think there, you know, what's often missed is that it still needs to be pivoted, right, from time to time, based on the experiments and the outcomes that you generate from something like product discovery. You need to use these results of the experiments to be emergent in your product strategy. So, yes, maybe you start off with one thing, but then you need to be able to iterate on that based on the learnings during this discovery process.
Yeah, and I love that you bring in the question of where are we in the product lifecycle, right? It goes back to that crossing the chasm. You know, are what side are you on? Are you now the apex animal in this ecosystem and you're about to be disrupted, or where are you? And there's probably a whole nother show in how you approach discovery, depending on where you are. Before we wrap up, I'm curious how you got interested in product discovery. And for people that are new to it, do you have suggestions? What the career path, what the learning cycle, some good resources for those beginners?
Yeah, when I look back about where I got sort of started in working in this way and thinking in this way, it comes back to my startup experience. So I co-founded two startups previously, one in the film industry and another one in the wine industry, many years ago now. But you know, when you're working in a startup-like environment, this is not really called product discovery, right? It's almost like the standard sort of way of working. And so, you know, my introduction to this way of working came, you know, when I was working in that environment, when I was working with in those two startups, to continuously check the problem space, look at potential solutions, iterate, and try and deliver based on the problems that we're trying to solve, right? I think this often gets watered down a little bit because things break at scale. So in larger organizations, you know, you focus more on maybe things like the product strategy, right? Rather than using it as something that's emergent, using it something that could be pivotable, you use it as, you know, as something that's de facto and that's sort of settled and written in stone and handed down from upper management. So yeah, that's a little bit about my background. That's how I got introduced to it. What I would suggest to people looking to implement certain things, certain parts of product discovery, is to start learning more about the different practices of product discovery. You know, break it down, look at the problem space, the solution space, look at the different techniques, look at different practices, try to understand where certain practices could be useful. The what, why framework is a great place to start for that. And try and experiment with these in your team, right? As I said earlier, you know, you would maybe end up learning a lot more about the practices themselves, but also about your team and the context in which you're working in, which will potentially lead to, you know, further improvements that you could take next steps on. So yeah, you know, start with the practices, try and apply each one, and you know, it's this sort of shift in focus from trying to stop gathering requirements to starting gathering evidence, right? So you want to sort of think in that way a little bit.
Yeah, the experimental approach. Well, we're coming up near the end of our time box. I want to give you a chance to share any upcoming events, give some shout outs, let our listeners know what's the best way to get in touch with you to keep the conversation going.
Yeah, well, thank you, Andy and Colleen, firstly, for asking me to be a part of this show. It's been a blast having this conversation with you guys. And I hope we've given your listeners some takeaways that they can maybe think about and try and experiment with in their own field of work. I do have an on-demand product discovery course, which is based on a lot of the things that we talked about today. So if audience members would like to discuss about getting this workshop with their organization, please reach out to me through agile-atelier.com. And you can also reach out to me on LinkedIn and on Twitter.
I guess that's the word I should have asked you how to pronounce, huh? I keep calling it.
That's also something where you can't go wrong, right? It's Atelier, Atelier.
Well, thank you again for joining us today, Rahul. It was really great to chat with you about this. This is something that I think all of us can relate to and feel like it's just not a place that we spend enough time thinking about, talking about, or trying to change. So we appreciate your perspective and joining us today. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a review, a rating, or leave comments on iTunes, Stitcher, or the podcast platform of your choice. It helps others find us and helps us share this great content. If this is your first time tuning in, please consider subscribing to our podcast. And if you'd like to join the discussion and share your stories about product discovery, as well as discovery around craft beer, or even more recently, gin has been our topic of alcohol choice during COVID. join us at coalition.agileuprising.com. And finally, support from listeners like you help us cover our hosting and podcast costs. So please check out the show notes and how you can become a patron and help us keep this going. Until next time, this is the Agile Uprising podcast, signing out.
Be good. Wash your hands. Wear your mask.